on the plane, and it'll be a few hours before he can do anything about it. By then, it'll be lying in the bottom of the Chicago River, which, he noticed while crossing the State Street Bridge, is conveniently not frozen over. Okay, you're all set. We have you in room 1421. Smiling, the clerk hands back his credit card and a room key. Thank you, Mr. Armano. Enjoy your stay. The cottage Randy's renting is strictly no frills. Living room, bedroom, marked by a brass plate that reads Captain's Quarters, tacked above the door frame. A kitchen with a similar sign that announces the galley, and literally is one, barely large enough to hold the requisite stove, sink, and fridge. The bathroom, naturally, is marked poop deck. Charming, isn't it? Randy tugs the front door, trying to get it to close tightly. It's very kitschy. That's the kindest word she can think of. At least it's furnished. Not exactly Ethan Allen, though. More like the kind of stuff you buy in a box with instructions and put together yourself. Lucinda looks around at the bookshelves shaped like upended rowboats, end tables made from ship's wheels, lamps with lighthouse bases. The sailboat-sprigged blue couch and chair slipcovers have that dank, beachy mildew smell that reminds Lucinda of canvas lawn chairs left moldering too long in a sealed shed. On the knotty pine walls are framed nautical charts and a seascape painting Lucinda immediately pegs as a paint-by-number. Kind of makes me want to sing Anchors Away, she tells Randy, and is rewarded by a faint smile. You're too hoarse to sing, he tells her. Want some tea with honey instead of coffee? No, thanks. I need the caffeine. Tea has caffeine. Not enough for me. You know I like the strong stuff. How about a shot of whiskey in the coffee, then? My mother would say, that'll cure all that ails ye, he adds in an expert brogue. I have to drive. Plain old coffee's good. Do you mind if I plug in my BlackBerry while I'm here? The battery's dead, and I need to make a call before I get on the road. There's an outlet somewhere here. He moves aside several cardboard boxes stacked in a corner. Here it is. Hand me the cord. She inserts her phone into the other end and hands it to him. Are you still moving in? She asks, eyeing the boxes. No, that stuff belongs to the people who own the place. They didn't want to haul it back up to the city over the winter. What is all that? Who knows? Probably seashells and lobster traps. She flashes the obligatory smile, but hates that Randy is living like this, in a drafty, kitschy cottage that's barely been winterized, surrounded by other people's boxed-up belongings and pressboard furniture. Maybe you can move back home to your house now, she suggests, as he fumbles around with the cord, trying to get the plug to stick in an outlet that won't seem to grip it. I need to plug this in someplace else, he mutters and straightens. She follows him to the kitchen, more knotty pine and seagull-printed vinyl wallpaper. The lone wall outlet is occupied by a can opener and coffee maker. He yanks the can opener cord to vacate a receptacle, plugs in her phone, then takes the carafe from the coffee pot and turns on the tap at the sink. Randy, maybe you can move back home, she repeats, thinking he might not have heard the suggestion before. Her voice is wearing away quickly. The answer comes immediately this time, and she realizes he heard her the first. I don't want to move back. He fills the carafe, his back to her. I didn't mean right this second. I know it's too soon to make any decisions, but that's your house, and... No, it's actually her house. He turns off the water and faces her. I mean, it was hers.
All hers?
When Zelda died, she left Carla some money and her condo. Carla rented it out for a while, but then she sold it and bought the house out here.
You didn't buy it together?
No. He dumps the water into the coffee maker. Things have been bad for a while, Lucinda. A long while. I guess we both knew it wasn't going to last.
For how long?
Let's see. Right after we walked down the aisle? Or maybe even before. Then why did you marry her? She wants to ask. But talk about a loaded question. Now is not the time to ask it. Don't get me wrong. I loved her. But I knew it wasn't in the right way. And I knew it wasn't ever going to be enough. Eventually, we were basically going through the motions. Both of us. Not just me.
What happened?
I fell out of love with her, he says simply. And she fell in love with someone else. As he methodically measures coffee grounds into the filter basket, he adds, When I look back, it's hard to tell which of those things happened first.
She had someone else?
He nods. Jack Ramsden. Jack Ramsden. She heard that name earlier. Santiago asked Lambert if they had tracked him down yet, and Lambert said they were still trying. No one elaborated for the benefit of Lucinda and Neil, and she didn't want to ask many questions. He's a fisherman on the island, Randy tells her now. Been dating my wife for, I'd guess almost a year, give or take. The first few months of it behind my back, obviously.
But you knew they were seeing each other?
She follows him back to the living room as the coffee maker begins to hiss. Not right away. Unlike me, Carlo was a damned terrific liar. Randy sits on the sofa. The springs creak noisily. He looks at her. I can't believe I'm saying any of this. I mean, right now. Speaking ill of the dead is...
You don't have to explain yourself to me, Randy.
Lucinda sits, too, keeping a full cushion between them. It's tempting to rest her aching neck and back against the cushions as a wave of weariness washes over her. I was shocked when I found out what happened to her, and I was sick about it.
I know you were. Of course you were.
She was my wife. She was a good person. There's a but coming. She can tell by his tone. Well, of course there is. Randy isn't your typical grieving widower, not with a marriage that has long since crashed and burned. I cared about Carla. But the truth is, Lucinda, it was long over between us. We haven't lived together since September, and it feels like a lot longer. That was just when I finally got myself out.
That had to be so hard for you to do. Leave, I mean.
I wish I could say it was, but we both knew it was over way before then. And I wasn't going to tell you this, but what the hell? Her heart pounds. She has to force herself not to break eye contact, much as she longs to avoid what she sees in his eyes. It was seeing you again last July, out of the blue, that made me realize a lot of things.
Please don't say you left your wife for me, Randy, because...
No, I didn't leave her for you. I left her because of you. There's a difference.
I know.
She gets it. Really, she does. She knows what he's trying to say, but he shouldn't be saying it. Now is not the right time. Not when she's so tired she can't think straight, and she's going to lose her voice any minute. Not with Carla lying dead in the morgue and Lucinda, in the most bizarre twist imaginable, somehow involved. I didn't know if I was ever going to see you again, Randy tells her. After last summer, I mean. But knowing that when we reconnected, that I could still feel that way about you after all those years, about someone who wasn't my wife, well, it pretty much told me all I needed to know. It made me take the initiative to get out. Because I knew she never would.
Not even for, what was his name, Jack?
I doubt it. Carla has never been one to make decisions and changes. She lets herself be propelled. I mean, she did, he amends, and Lucinda glimpses a flash of sorrow in his eyes.
So where is Jack now?
Away. He's divorced, and his kids live somewhere in the Midwest. I'm not sure where. But Lambert said that when they checked with his neighbors, they all said they hadn't seen him in a few days, and he's been visiting his kids on their winter break. They're trying to track him down.
You don't think there's any chance that he...
Jack? No.
Based on what? Do you know him well?
Not really. He hasn't lived on the island very long, but based on sheer gut instinct as a cop, and the evidence we have so far, this is something bigger than Carla being killed in some lover's quarrel. It feels to me like... When he trails off, she completes his sentence. She knows where he's going. She thinks of Ava Neary, of all the pretty dead girls who supposedly took their own lives.
It feels like a serial killer.
And if it is, Randy tells her, he's going to do it again. Lucinda nods, sickened by the realization that he's already been in her apartment. He may still be watching her, following her, stalking his next victim. Before leaving for the airport, Vic was interviewed by a couple of agents who wanted to know whether he'd had any other recent contact from the anonymous person who'd sent the note, whether he'd seen anyone suspicious lately, whether he'd had phone call hang-ups, all the usual questions he himself would have once asked someone in his situation. He had nothing to tell them, other than that the note had arrived out of the blue. They assume, as Vic does, that the recent publicity about his book smoked the deadly phantom out of his hiding place, and that it might trigger him to start killing again. "We can only hope that's not the case," one of the agents told him before he left. "The local field office will be involved now," they told him. "They'll send agents out to Vic's house to investigate, and probably keep tabs on him to determine whether anyone is lurking." The long-ago profile he'd helped to create in the early years of the BSU will be resurrected, re-examined. They'll be looking for a nocturnal loner, intelligent, organized. A careless set of footprints found on the muddy grass leading to the sidewalk at an early crime scene before he perfected his M.O. indicated that back then he'd weighed about 200 pounds and worn a size 11 loafer. That particular crime had been committed on a busy suburban avenue at a time of night when others would have been on the streets. Yet he had walked, not run, away from the scene. Clearly, he was ordinary-looking enough to have managed to blend into the setting without anyone giving him a second glance. That image has haunted Vic all these years, an average Joe sauntering away into the night after hacking a woman to death in her own kitchen. The crime would be no less heinous were he a frenzied madman racing from the scene, but he sure as hell would have been easier to catch. Now, sitting in a crowded gate area at Dulles Airport, Vic thumbs through yet another newspaper, searching every headline. There are plenty of homicides in the news today, but none so far that match, at a glance, the night watchman's M.O. That doesn't mean he hasn't struck again, or isn't about to. Vic figures that chances are slim of his randomly stumbling across a murder that fits, particularly without the resources he'd have were he still a part of the Bureau. But what else has he got to do? What he really needs is the internet, so that he can check in a more methodical manner, beginning his search on recent dates when the moon was full, and working backward. But he doesn't have his laptop, and the business center here at the airport is closed. So he keeps looking, going through one paper after another from the stack he bought at Hudson News on the concourse after he learned that his flight has been delayed yet again. Weather is wreaking havoc up and down the East Coast. He has a feeling he's going to be stuck here all night. It shouldn't matter. Kitty isn't even home. He asked her to stay with a friend while he's away, just in case. "Just in case he's watching us?" she asked, matter-of-factly. "He's probably not watching us," he told her. "But chances are, he's watching someone." Ordinarily, on a night like this, with a storm blowing in, Frank Santiago would be focused on what lies ahead, counting on the departments being flooded with calls regarding car accidents, downed trees, that sort of thing. But tonight, the storm is the last thing on anyone's mind. Tonight, they've got a murder on their hands, and every bit of manpower, every resource they have, is aimed at figuring out what the hell happened to Carla Barraquette. That Neil Bullard has become involved has really thrown Frank for a loop. But then, it's no coincidence. It was Neil who asked him to hire Randy in the first place.
Why? Frank asked suspiciously. Is he in some kind of trouble there?
No, nothing like that.
It has to be something or you wouldn't be calling me.
He just needs a fresh start.
He's burnt out?
No. He's planning to get married. Wants to get away from the city, buy a house, raise a family someplace safe. You know the drill.
Yeah, Frank knew the drill. Detective work takes its toll on a guy, on his health, on his marriage. Frank knew. It just so happened that Frank had an opening on the township force at the time. Otherwise, he really could have given a shit about repaying a decades-old favor. He had other things to worry about. Chemo, radiation, endless tests, and then waiting for the numbers. Numbers. It was always about numbers. Still is. The numbers measure his blood levels and his tumors. The numbers essentially tell Frank Santiago, who never smoked a cigarette in his life, yet somehow found his lungs clogged with cancer cells, whether he will live or die in another couple of months. They continue to do so. The news isn't always good. Frank detests numbers, fears them. And so the irony hadn't escaped him today when Neil Bullard blew back into his life like a nor'easter, with numeric evidence to turn everything upside down. From the start, though, Frank had assumed they were dealing with a domestic case. Everyone knew Carla Barraquette had a lover, and at first, no one knew where Jack Ramsden was, other than that he was unaccounted for. Lover's quarrel gone bad. That was what Frank figured. But Jack Ramsden turned up in St. Louis with an airtight alibi right around the time Bullard showed up with the evidence. Evidence that, along with the bloody ring, soundly links the other woman to the crime, as far as Frank's concerned. Lucinda Sloane. Lucinda Sloane, who, he had realized earlier in the meeting, really might be a psychic after all. He's always had his doubts about that. But when he caught her looking at him in the meeting, some flash of empathy, or maybe sympathy, in her eyes, told him that she knows his dark secret. Somehow she picked up on the one thing he hasn't told anyone, and doesn't intend to, until it's absolutely necessary. Damn her, he'd thought, when he realized she knew. Why does she have to be involved in this case? Why indeed? He has his suspicions, had them before she barged into his private hell. Why would she just hand over the ring, though, if she were involved in Carla's murder? Why wouldn't she have hidden it? It doesn't make sense. But if Frank looks hard enough, it will. Of that, he's certain. Lucinda, after all, is the reason Randy Barraquette was so hot to get out of Philadelphia. Any skilled detective, hell, any human being with eyes and ears could figure that out after spending 5 minutes in the same room with the two of them. Frank had certainly done his share of that last summer when she was in town working on the Pearson and Hastings cases. It was no accident that the Barraquette's marriage crashed and burned weeks later. And it was obvious, if anyone cared, which Frank really didn't at the time, that Randy Barraquette and Lucinda Sloane must have picked up right where they left off. They've managed to cover their trail remarkably well until now. Now that Lucinda Sloane has found reason to kill off the competition in an elaborate setup, making it look like the work of a homicidal stranger, all bets are off. Anything is possible. For all Frank knows, Randy was in on it. Lambert probably doesn't think so, they're buddies, and Lambert is an earnest type, which sometimes serves him well in police work and sometimes does not, which is why Frank is going to have to sit him down and make it very clear that he is not to involve Randy in this investigation. It shouldn't be necessary, but he has a feeling it is. Frank already briefly cautioned him before Lambert left to take Randy over to the morgue not to reveal any of the details of the case that weren't already revealed earlier in the meeting.
"There are things we can't have getting out," Frank told Lambert,
who certainly knows the drill. That's how it always works with a homicide investigation. You keep certain details from the public and the press, details only the killer and those at the scene could possibly know. Like the bright red lipstick Carla Barakat was wearing. Lipstick she sure as hell didn't apply herself, unless she was trying to look like a demented clown.
"You didn't tell Randy about the lipstick she had on, did you?"
Frank asked Lambert, just to be sure. "Are you kidding? She was his wife." "Was" being the key word.
"I didn't tell him anything like that. Why would I want to upset him even more?"
"That's good," Frank said, knowing Randy wouldn't see the lipstick at the morgue. It had, of course, been washed away, along with the blood, when the corpse was prepared for viewing. "You do your best never to let the family members see anything upsetting when they get their last look at their dead loved one. But photographic evidence remains. Other evidence, too. Plenty of it. Frank fully intends to keep the specifics from being revealed to anyone outside the immediate investigation, including Neil Bullard and Randy Barakat and Lucinda Sloan. Just in case the official shadow of suspicion falls on one, or for all he knows, more of them.
Chapter 10. "Sorry, I need to answer this," Randy tells Lucinda, after checking caller ID on his ringing cell phone.
"It's okay."
She stretches, rubs her eyes.
"I should go."
"No, not yet. Is it wrong for him to need her so badly tonight? Her company, her comforting presence, and more. More than that. Yes, it's wrong, but he can't help it."
"It's getting late."
She starts gathering her things. The phone is still ringing. Randy has to get it. But first he has to make her stay. "It's not that late."
"It feels like the middle of the night."
"But you need coffee."
"That's okay."
"No, I already made it. Just let me take this call, and then we'll have coffee."
"Okay,"
she says around a yawn and leans back. Relieved, Randy snaps open his phone.
"What's up, Dan?"
"Where are you?"
"Home. Why?"
"Home where?"
"The cottage."
"Are you alone there?"
Randy hesitates.
"No. Why?"
There's a long pause, as if Lambert is wondering whether he should ask who might be there with him, as if he doesn't know.
"I was going to swing over there. There's something you should take a look at."
"Want me to come down to headquarters?"
"No," Lambert says quickly. "You're home, stay put. The weather's crummy. I'll just tell you about it."
"Tell me about what?" he asks, conscious of Lucinda beside him, trying to act as though she's not listening to his side of the conversation, as if she can help it. He supposes he can go into the next room to take the call, but really, he has nothing to hide from her. Not anymore.
"You're never going to believe this, Randy."
"What?"
He rakes his hands up his forehead, overtired, losing patience.
"You know how you mentioned after we left the morgue that Carla was wearing a watch with her pajamas, and that was unusual? I went back over there after I dropped you off, and I checked out the watch. It was a Freestyle. Are you familiar with that brand?"
"No."
"Nothing fancy. The strange thing is, the battery was dead. The hands were stopped at 5:40.
Randy can feel Lucinda trying to catch his eye, but he can't even look at her, his heart racing. Why would Carla wear a watch with a dead battery?
"And Randy, the watch was engraved. on the back.
Engraved?
Yes.
What did it say?
Dan clears his throat.
Just the date she died and numbers, that's all. Decimals. 74.2 and 39.6.
74.2 and 39.6, Randy repeats, with chilling recognition, as Lucinda snaps blatantly to attention beside him. A quick perusal of the local publications in the hotel room tells him that West Division Street is where all the action is. Looks fairly easy to find, according to the map. He could take a cab. God knows he's got plenty of ones to pay the fare, courtesy of the dead bartender's wallet loaded with tips. But he has all the time in the world tonight, and he wants to relish every minute. He'll stroll over. This has always been his favorite part, the anticipatory stage. The search, trolling for the perfect woman, considering and discarding potential candidates, waiting for the one who speaks to something inside him when he spots her, the one who fits the bill. He was cheated out of that last time. Carla Barakat was a necessity, but she didn't fill his needs, really. Not the way all the others had. He had expected the kill to be diminished because of that, had wondered whether he might even have misgivings about it after it was over, like with his mother. But that was different. With her, there was no anticipatory stage, no search, no plan. Mother was never meant to die. Not at his hands, anyway. Unlike those who came before her. Unlike Carla and those who will come after. Including Lucinda Sloane. For a good 15 minutes, Lucinda and Randy have analyzed the numbers, where they've appeared, what they might mean, what message Carla's killer is trying to convey.
I feel like my brain just isn't working,
Lucinda finally admits, sagging against the cushions, fighting yawn after yawn, aching with exhaustion.
Mine isn't either. I'm wiped out.
She nods. She should get moving. Grab that cup of coffee. Call Cam. Go. Get moving, then. But her energy has been utterly depleted. She just needs to sit here a moment longer before facing the long drive.
I still can't believe it. Randy says again, mostly to himself.
I can't believe someone just walked into that house and killed her.
Did Carla say anything at all to make you think she felt like she was in danger?
Carla didn't say anything at all to me, period. We exchanged a few emails, stuff about the lawyers, accounts, that kind of thing. But we didn't talk anymore.
That's so.
She shuts her mouth, thinking better of what she was about to say.
What?
Just, it's so ironic that you weren't even speaking to each other in the end, and yet you were her next of kin.
It would be different if we were divorced, but that was still a ways away. The thing is, I'm not just her next of kin. I'm her sole heir. I spoke to Greg Jeanette today. He's her lawyer, and he told me she hadn't updated her will in a few years.
Was she planning to, do you think?
Probably. But like I said, she wasn't one to take much initiative. And anyway, she didn't have close family left, and her friends, well, they kind of came and went over the years. So,
he breaks off as what sounds like a bucket full of marbles patters against the house.
What was that?
Lucinda jumps up and follows him to the window. Randy flips off the inside light so they can see out.
Sleet. He says unnecessarily.
For a moment, they're both silent. Side by side in the dark, they look out at the frozen precipitation slanting from the sky on a misty wind that rocks the tree branches.
You can't go out in that.
Lucinda was just thinking the same thing.
I'll be fine.
Not very convincing, but she has to go. She can't stay here with him.
You won't be fine. Stay with me tonight.
No.
Lucinda, there's not a reason in the world you should go out in that.
Yes, there is. Standing here alone in the dark with him is just as unnerving as the storm outside. And the sudden ring of a phone pierces the air. Her cell. Randy flicks the light on again. She goes to the kitchen to answer the phone, leaving it plugged into the wall, knowing the battery has barely begun to charge. It's Neil, of course, wondering why she hasn't called.
Hi, Neil. What's up?
Are you okay? You sound sick.
That's just my voice. You know how it gets when I'm tired.
Are you on the road yet?
No,
she admits, watching Randy fill two mugs with steaming coffee.
Then don't go anywhere. It's miserable out here. The causeways glare ice, cars spinning out and off the road everywhere.
Oh, no.
Randy shoots her a questioning look, wondering, no doubt, whether there's been some new development in the case.
The roads are bad,
she tells him.
Neil doesn't want me to leave here.
That makes two of us.
Ignoring the comment and his blue, blue eyes, she turns her back a little, telling Neil,
I'll wait it out for a while then.
Wait it out until tomorrow. It's going to get worse before it gets better. The temperature will keep dropping overnight.
What about you?
I'll make it home. I've driven through worse.
I'm sure I have, too.
You stay where you are. Do you hear me?
Bristling at his authoritative tone, she reminds herself that he's only trying to keep her safe. Here alone, overnight, with Randy.
Yeah, that's safe.
Hanging up the phone, Lucinda covers a yawn.
You can have the lovely captain's quarters.
Randy arcs a hand toward the bedroom.
I'll sleep on the couch.
I'm not putting you out of your bed tonight. I'll take the couch.
No, you won't.
As she opens her mouth to protest, he stops her, saying,
I'm going to stay up a while, and you look ready for bed.
I have to make a phone call first.
I forgot. Do you still want coffee?
She eyes the two cups he's just filled. Coffee will keep her up. It'll keep them both up. Sleep. Sleep is safe.
I guess there's no need for coffee if I don't have to drive.
I was just thinking the same thing.
Randy pours the coffee out in the sink.
What I could really use is a drink.
I was just thinking the same thing,
she admits, and smiles faintly. Randy reaches up into a cupboard. Standing behind him, still holding her phone, she tries not to watch his sweater ride up, revealing the muscles of his lower back. He pulls down a bottle of Jack Daniels and plunks it on the counter, then looks at Lucinda. When she nods her approval, he wordlessly throws a couple of ice cubes into two glasses and pours. The phone in her hand beeps as she reaches for her drink.
Another call?
No,
she tells Randy.
It means I've got messages.
No surprise, after a couple of days with no battery. She sips her drink, relishing the burn of bourbon sliding down her throat.
I need to check my voicemail before I make my call, she tells him. Is it okay if I go into your bedroom?
Randy nods and gulps his drink, as befits a man who's been through hell in the last 36 hours. Cam has always loved a good storm. When Mike is home, and nobody has to go anywhere. When they can cuddle by a roaring fire in the brick-walled, sunken sunroom that stretches along the back of the house, watching the snow fall past the tall windows and French doors. If Mike were here tonight instead of still out in Utah, she'd feel cozy as opposed to uneasy, listening to the wind howl and toss freezing rain at the windows. Well, maybe not cozy. The baby's been fussy all evening. Every time Cam thinks she has her settled, she wakes fitfully 10 or 15 minutes later, crying.
Maybe it's just from her cold,
Tess suggests, walking her wailing sister across the floor as Cam hunts for the infant thermometer to see if the fever is back.
Her nose is still kind of runny.
Thermometer in hand at last, Cam checks the baby. She's got a fever. Poor little thing, Hang on to her, Tess, while I see if I've got enough Tylenol drops to get her through the night. Cam looks in the medicine cabinet in the half-bath off the kitchen. The infant Tylenol is almost gone. If Mike were here, he'd run out to Rite Aid. If Mike were here, if Mike were here. How did she ever get through all those months without him last year? The phone rings just as she returns to the kitchen to take the whimpering baby from Tess. That's Daddy, she says with absolute certainty. When two people have been a couple for as long as they have, and through as much together as they have, they don't have to be psychic to know when they're needed. Can you grab the phone for me and tell him I'll call him back in a few minutes when I get Grace settled down? Sure. Cam walks her miserable daughter into the next room, rubbing her back and bouncing her a little. It's okay, Grace. Mom is here. Mom is here. Shh. Mom, it's for you. Tess appears in the doorway with the phone. It's not Daddy. It's Lucinda. Lucinda. Cam wondered when she was going to hear back from her. Then the baby grew fussy and Cam got busy with her and forgot. Telling Lucinda about the note in the mail seems a lot less urgent now, but she takes the call anyway, handing Grace over to Tess. Walk her up to her room and show her the stuffed animals. She likes that. Grace sobs, and Tess gives Cam a dubious look. Whatever. Come on, Grace. Let's go see Lammy and Kitty Cat. Cam returns to the kitchen with the phone. Of course, she didn't tell Tess about the anonymous message in the mail. She's not going to bring it up now, when Tess finally put last summer's nightmare behind her. We all have. But it refuses to die. Lucinda?
Cam!
The voice on the other end of the line is raspy.
Is everything all right?
Everything's fine. Are you sick?
No, just tired. I got all those messages, and I thought something awful must have happened.
No, nothing like that. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
My cell battery died, and I've been in the middle of something the last few days.
Something tells Cam that whatever something is, it's not pleasant. Are you all right? Other than being tired, I mean.
Yes. Long story, and I've been meaning to call you and tell you about it, but first, tell me why you called me.
Cam opens the drawer and reaches toward the back, where she stashed the envelope. It's about my sister, actually. She hears a gasp on the other end of the line and, startled, stops rifling through the drawer. What's wrong? She asks Lucinda.
Nothing. Just what about your sister? Randy?
Sitting on the couch, empty glass in hand, he finds his morbid thoughts taking an abrupt detour when he looks up to see Lucinda standing in the bedroom doorway. He had been wondering about the arrangements that will have to be made when Carla's body is released. Now his bourbon-infused brain wonders what it would be like if he'd never married Carla at all, if Lucinda were his wife, if that bedroom over her shoulder belonged to the two of them instead of to the captain, if he could sweep her right back in there and hold her and never let her go.
We've got to call Santiago right away. And Neil, we've got to talk to Neil.
The urgency in Lucinda's hoarse voice and the grim look on her face swipe errant thoughts from Randy's mind. What happened?
That was Cam Hastings. She got a note in the mail, a picture of her sister Ava and a note that said, I know what happened to her. Solve it, and if you are right, you will find me. Cam said there are a bunch of misspellings.
He considers that. Does his best to, anyway. Wishing he hadn't finished a glass of bourbon while she was on the phone in the bedroom. His analytical powers are shot, damn it. Still, remembering all the kooks and cranks who popped up after he and Lucinda and the Hastings did their round of media interviews last August, he says, it might not have anything to do with...
It was written in red lipstick.
He curses under his breath. Like your mirror.
Did Carla... Did she wear red lipstick?
He shakes his head.
Never?
No, never.
You're that sure?
Positive. It was a thing with Carla. Makeup. My mother-in-law worked at one of those department store cosmetics counters. Store cosmetics counters. Is he slurring? Zelda figured out Carla's best colors, he forges on, and she always wore pink lipstick. Always. Pink. And blue eyeshadow. I hate it. Blue eyeshadow. Looks cheap. But you know what? She wears it anyway. She says it goes with her eyes. Said, he amends, remembering. Blue eyes. They both had blue eyes, he and Carla. Back when he still thought they had a chance in hell of making it together, he had imagined the blue-eyed children they would have. Basic genetics. Blue eyes plus blue eyes equals blue eyes.
What do you think it means?
He looks at Lucinda. She's not talking about all those little squares. What the heck do you call those little squares in biology class? Lucinda has brown eyes. Big brown eyes. One pair of big brown eyes plus one pair of blue eyes, his, equals... But what does it equal? Blue? Brown? He should have paid more attention. No, he shouldn't be paying attention at all. Not to her eyes. Not to his feelings for her. Not tonight.
Randy?
Yeah?
Are you okay? Really?
Yeah.
Then what do you think it means?
She asks again. What does he think it means? What does he think what means? He leans his head back against the couch cushion, attempting to backtrack along the conversational path, but his thoughts are hopelessly entangled. Damned bourbon.
The red lipstick, she reminds him. It was on my mirror, too. And I swear, Randy, when Neil mentioned that today, when we were in the meeting, Van Aken and Lambert exchanged a look, as if, I swear it meant something to them. Does it to you?
Does it to you? Does it to you? Red lipstick. She's talking about red lipstick.
Hell no.
She looks at him for a minute.
Are you okay?
I'm drunk,
he says helplessly. She nods.
I'm going to call Neil.
Okay. He closes his eyes, just to rest them for a minute. Beneath an overcast, moonless sky, he walks through the cold along Rush Street toward West Division, past restaurants and bars crowded with patrons even on a weeknight, most of them young, some spilling out onto the sidewalks to smoke. He buys himself a beer in one of the bars, not because he wants to, but because he has to. He buys a pack of cigarettes, same reasoning. He drinks the beer with his back to the bar, and then he goes outside and he smokes a few cigarettes, and he tries not to shiver in the bitter cold. He'd rather not linger too long inside, where the bartenders and waitstaff at least are sober, watchful. He watches the carefree patrons, many of them inebriated, not even shivering as they smoke and laugh and talk in the frigid Chicago night. They don't see him. No one gives him a second glance. Not the guys who are focused on the girls, and not the girls who are focused on the guys their own age, unaware of the predator in their midst. Lucinda stands over Randy, wondering what to do. She shook him a few times, but there's no waking him. His head is thrown back, mouth open, chest rising and falling in slow, rhythmic breathing. He needs sleep. So does she. Neil reminded her of that just now, before they hung up.
Get some rest, he said, after they'd discussed the latest development. We'll go over everything tomorrow.
You get home safely.
She was worried about him, still on the road from the shore to Philadelphia. It's slow going, he told her. Accidents everywhere.
I'm glad you stayed there, Sin.
So is she.
especially now that Randy's asleep and she doesn't have to worry about, well, anything. Her throat aches with the effort of forcing sound. Another sip of bourbon soothes it a little, but she pours the rest into the sink. She needs sleep. Now. She goes back into the bedroom and takes the quilt, embroidered with nautical flags, of course, off the rumpled bed. Back in the living room, she covers Randy with it, gently tucking the edges around his shoulders and legs. He doesn't stir. She props a life preserver embellished throw pillow beneath his head. He's still sound asleep, but at least he looks more comfortable. Encouraged, she kneels and takes off his boots. Okay, better yet. But that's as far as it goes. He'll be fine. She stands and watches him sleep for a moment, remembering that she did this once before, years ago. She watched him sleeping on the final night they were together, and shouldn't have been. The night when she came to the realization that she had to end it. She extracted herself from his naked embrace, got out of bed, and snuck away. But only after giving him a long, last look, memorizing everything about him. She knew they would see each other again, that they would go on working together for as long as they had to, but was certain she would never again experience the intimacy of watching him sleep. She was wrong, but never in a million years could she have imagined the incredible series of events that had led them from that moment to this. Shaking her head, she goes into the bedroom and slips between sheets that smell of Randy, resting her head on a pillow that smells of Randy. She leaves the light on. Outside, the wind roars, hurtling pellets of ice against the house. After a few minutes of listening to the storm's fury, she gets up and digs her iPod out of her coat pocket. Settling back in bed with the earbuds in her ears, she presses the scroll wheel, hoping to find some soothing music on one of the playlists she uploaded before Curacao. Wait a minute. What's going on? Where is all her music? How can Beethoven's Piano Sonata 14 be the only song file on the iPod? She didn't put it here. She did, however, load the iPod with hundreds of other songs, all of which are somehow missing. Did she accidentally erase all the files somehow? She must have. But then, how the heck did Sonata 14 end up on here? She's not big on classical music. It's not that she doesn't like it. She just knows absolutely nothing about it. Could she possibly have picked up someone else's iPod by mistake? Must be. An iPod that belongs to someone whose only song choice is classical piano, written over 200 years ago. An iPod that's encased in an identical mint green leather skin. Okay, that might be the only thing that makes sense, but it's a reach. It's also not the case, because when she slips the iPod out of the skin to check the back of it, she sees her initials and telephone number etched there. The engraving was free when she ordered it from the website on her last birthday, a gift to herself. So it's definitely her iPod. Without her music. With unfamiliar music. Or maybe, she realizes after she presses play, not so unfamiliar at all. Lucinda's heard Sonata 14 before, many times. Even she, with her limited knowledge of classical music, knows the famous piece, only not as Sonata 14. She knows it by its more familiar name. Moonlight Sonata. It's freaking freezing out here, and it's getting late. And as much as he'd hoped to find her on this first night and not waste any time, he finally decides to call it a night. He stomps out his cigarette on a sidewalk scraped dry and clean of snow, and he starts to walk away. This is when it happens. A cigarette butt, still smoldering, lands by his feet. A butt stained scarlet at the tip. He looks up, slowly. And there she is. a buxom blonde in a red dress, laughing with her friends, oblivious to him as she shakes another menthol out of her pack. He watches as she purses the cigarette between luscious lips, the dense, sugary red of a summer tomato. As she lights up, he smiles a satisfied smile. The clock has just started ticking. The countdown begun again. Lucinda stares at the framed nautical map of Long Beach Island on the wall opposite the bed, wondering how she can possibly still be awake. It's not the storm. That's died down quite a bit in the hour since she climbed into bed. And it's not that she's not tired, because her body aches with fatigue, and it's all she can do to form coherent thoughts. It's not that the light is on, because she's used to that. It's the iPod. Someone tampered with it. Someone was on her computer, accessing her music files. Someone replaced them with a haunting Beethoven sonata that means nothing to her. Should it? She can't seem to shake the nagging feeling that she's missing something. Maybe not anything to do with the iPod, but some clue that's right under her nose. Was it something Cam said when they spoke earlier? Or Neil? She's gone over both conversations repeatedly, coming up with nothing. Neil was intrigued by the letter Cam had received, particularly because it was written in red lipstick.
"There's something about the lipstick, Neil," she told him. "The local cops here aren't telling us everything."
"Of course they aren't. They were humoring us by having us there. Humoring Randy, really."
"Not really. We're the ones with the evidence, and they're going to be working with the police in Philly. You are the police in Philly."
"But I'm personally involved. No one on the investigation is going to trust me, or you, for that matter, with any information we don't already have. For all they know, we could be involved."
By we, he meant she.
"Do you think they're still suspicious of me, Neil?"
she asked worriedly.
"Why would they be? You have an alibi. You were away all weekend. Jimmy was with you, and he can vouch for it. Don't worry, Sin, they're not suspicious of you."
There was a click on the line, and he said,
"I have to go. That's Irma calling me. She's worried sick about me out here on the road."
"So am I. Please get home safely."
By then, her voice was a mere whisper. Efforts to clear her throat brought mere squeaks of sound. "Hopefully it'll be better tomorrow." "It will be, if you get some rest." Lucinda punches the too fat, goose-down pillow beneath her head and tries desperately to fall asleep. Nothing doing. Cam Hastings was rattled, to say the least, to hear of the possible connection between her sister's death and Carla Barakat's.
"It's too huge a coincidence, don't you think?"
she asked Lucinda.
"To think that whoever killed my sister killed Carla?" "Not if whoever killed your sister read or saw on TV that we were looking for more information about Ava's death. You and I and Randy were all out there. Our names, our faces. We were on national TV, Cam. Do you know how many people we reached?"
"And do you think one of them was responsible for Ava's death?"
"Or knew something about it."
"What about Carla, though?"
"That's just it.
What about Carla? What if her killer is still here on the island? What if he followed Lucinda and Randy over here tonight and is hovering somewhere nearby right now?" She looks at the map on the wall, gauging the distance between this cottage and the Barakat's house, between this cottage and the police station. Is there a legend? What's the scale? As she searches the fringes of the map, something jumps out at her. Shocked, she sits up in bed, leans closer, gets out, and hurries over to the wall to examine the map.
Can it be?
Lucinda gasps, clapping a hand over her mouth in utter astonishment.
"Oh my God,"
she whispers, then tries to scream.
"Randy!"
The effort is futile. Her voice is shot. She hurries to the next room, frantically whispering,
Randy, wake up.
Part 2, 705. Chapter 11. Weeks' worth of paranoia come rushing back to haunt Jamie Dobiak the moment she walks into her bedroom to see him standing there. Hello, Jamie? All this time, she'd been feeling as though something wasn't right, as though someone might have been in her apartment. Things were moved around. Things were missing. Her new yellow scarf seemed to have vanished overnight from the bedpost where she was certain she'd left it. Yet even now, she wants to believe he is whom he'd claimed to be all along, a harmless new neighbor from down the block whose path has occasionally crossed hers these last few weeks.
What are you doing here?
She breaks off, seeing the knife. She tries to run, but he's got her by the arm, his strong bicep pressed against her face, muffling her cries for help. At 22 years old, Isaiah Drew was on the cusp of becoming the first one in his family to graduate college, Ivy League, no less, when he disappeared off a South Philly street over the weekend. This isn't the first time Lucinda's been called in to investigate a missing student at the University of Pennsylvania. Typically, someone goes off on a bender or a spontaneous road trip or caves under the rigorous academic pressure and simply checks out for a while. Those cases tend to have happier endings than most. This one won't. Drugs, she tells Neil, who's standing in the doorway as cops and campus security behind him keep curious dorm residents at bay. Neil shakes his head slightly.
No.
I'm not asking you, Neil. I'm telling you. He was involved in drugs.
I'm not saying I don't believe you, Neil responds. But that would be news to his roommate and his RA and his friends. Every person we've talked to who knew Isaiah says he was a good kid. Clean.
I don't think so.
But you're not sure?
Lucinda hesitates. Ordinarily, she wouldn't. Ordinarily, she'd trust her instincts and tell Neil that, yes, she's sure. This evening, though, she's not able to focus 100% of her energy on her work. She feels as though a pall is hanging over her, has felt it all day, even before Neil called to summon her to the campus. She rests her hand on the pillow where Isaiah reportedly took a nap before heading out onto the street and vanishing. Nothing comes to her. It isn't just this evening. Her perceptive abilities simply haven't been up to par since she received an odd package in the mail the other day. The package bore a typewritten label and no return address. It had been postmarked in Chicago. She turned it over to the police without opening it. Inside, she learned, was a yellow silk Hermes scarf. That was all. Lucinda wanted so badly to believe that there was no connection, after all, between the brutal murder of Carla Barakat and the strange communication over the same period of days. Now, of course, it's clear that was no coincidence. She's known that from the moment she was compelled to look at that nautical chart of Long Beach Island in Randy's rental house almost a month ago. 74.2, 39.6. The precise longitude and latitude of Beach Haven, New Jersey. The second set of numbers proved to be the longitude and latitude of Chicago. Are they, and the scarf, meant to indicate that the killer has struck there as well? Or that he intends to? Lucinda is taking no chances. Neil had her laptop examined and found that someone had disabled her spyware and installed a keyboard sniffer, surveillance software that is notoriously difficult to detect unless you're looking for it, and sometimes not even then. She hasn't let her guard down, not even when she's alone in her apartment. Plagued by insomnia, she asked the doctor for a prescription sleeping pill when she was recently there for the flu. She filled the prescription, but hasn't been able to bring herself to take a pill just yet.
Why on earth not?
Bradley asked her over the phone the other morning,
when she confessed to yet another sleepless night.
Because I don't like medication. I'm afraid I won't be in control if I take it.
Lord knows you like to be in control, he agreed.
You know, you'd sleep a lot better if you'd just turn out the lights like the rest of the world.
How do you know that I don't?
Honey, the whole world knows you're afraid of the dark.
What do you mean?
You said it in one of those interviews you did on television. Don't you remember?
She shrugged.
She said a lot of things in those interviews. None of them yielded a solid clue to what happened to Ava Neary. If the police have reopened the investigation into her death, as Lucinda had expected them to, they've given her no information. For all she knows, they consider it a dead end.
Solve it, and you will find me.
It's such an odd phrase. It's been nagging at her.
So has the scrapbook.
If only someone else had gotten a good look at it. Sometimes she wonders if anyone even believes what she saw in it. Anyone other than Neil, that is.
Or Cam. Lucinda gave her as many names and details as she could recall. Cam said she was going to look into it.
Lucinda plans to get involved, too, just as soon as she's able. But right now she has other things on her plate. And right now she's not supposed to be thinking about Ava Neary. She closes her eyes, tries to concentrate. Isaiah Drew.
The first time Jamie met him, he was strolling by her building. He kindly held the door open for her when she came home with a rare armload of groceries. He even carried the bags up the stairs, where they chatted pleasantly while she unlocked her door. He kind of reminded her of her grandfather, back when Grandpa Dobiak was a little younger and not so sick. A few days after that, he was canvassing the neighborhood with a petition and asked her to sign it. Something about air pollution. Of course, Jamie signed. Who wouldn't? Who isn't against air pollution? Okay, maybe she did think it might be a little hypocritical, since she happens to be a smoker. But seriously, what do her measly cigarettes and some occasional weed matter in the grand scheme of things?
Thanks so much, said her harmless new neighbor, looking at her signature.
What's your name?
Jemima?
She laughed. Bad handwriting.
It's Jamie. What's yours?
Joe, he said. And from that blustery early March day on, they were on a first-name basis whenever they passed in the street.
Hey, Jamie.
What's up, Joe?
Just her harmless new grandfatherly neighbor.
Please,
Jamie begs him, panting in terror, cowering on the floor beside her bed, watching the knife in his black, gloved hand.
Please don't hurt me.
I wouldn't waste my breath if I were you, he advises calmly. You have so few left.
Isaiah Drew. Lucinda pictures his face, sees his brown eyes, furtive, and the pupils are dilated. Sees his hand, practiced, steady, cutting white powder on a mirror with a razor blade. She opens her eyes and shakes her head.
I'm definitely getting something about drugs, Neil. This room should be searched.
It's already been searched.
For residue?
For anything at all.
So search again. Bring in drug-sniffing dogs.
Sin, I don't think.
Are you saying I don't know what I'm talking about? She snaps and immediately regrets it. Look, I'm sorry. I'm having an off night.
Really? He asks dryly. I hadn't noticed.
Sorry, she says again. I'm just giving you what I'm getting. I know it doesn't mesh with who you think this kid was, but it's what I feel in this room, okay?
Neil looks at her for a long time, as if he wants to ask her something. Something that has nothing to do with Isaiah Drew. But he merely shrugs and says,
okay, we'll bring in dogs.
He allows the tip of the knife to jab, but just barely, the skin on her neck.
No,
Jamie sobs.
Please, no.
Oh, for the love of Pete, you're not crying, are you? Didn't your mother ever tell you that only babies cry?
Please, please don't hurt me.
All right. Not yet.
He moves the knife back and glances at the window above her head, or the digital clock on the nightstand, or both. We still have some time.
Why are you doing this?
She sobs hysterically.
Why?
Joe tilts his gray head. Why? Good question. And you know what, Jamie? I'm going to answer it for you. It's only fair. And like I said, we still have time.
Cam Neary?
Ava Neary's little sister?
Girl, is this really you?
It's really me, she says into the telephone, wishing she found the voice on the other end of the line the least bit familiar. She'd been so young, though, the last time she'd heard it. Too young to remember the voice, but not the name.
How are you, Bernice?
I'm doing all right, doing all right.
Bernice Watts, Ava's best friend all the way through high school, had grown up across the street from them in Camden, a fellow latchkey kid in a neighborhood filled with single-parent families. Bernice's widowed mother was a good cook, a real church-going, family-focused, maternal kind of woman, unlike Brenda Neary. Mrs. Watts was always good to Ava, a fixture in the Watts household from the time she was old enough to cross the street alone, by their parents' lax judgment, anyway. Cam remembers often toddling along with her and eating homemade cookies at the Watts' kitchen table with a horde of other kids, most of them Bernice's siblings. Ava and Bernice spent a lot of their time together studying, both determined to go to college. It paid off in scholarships, and when Ava went off to NYU, Bernice enrolled at Rutgers. It was through their alumni association that Cam managed to find her, married, with children and grandchildren, living in Trenton.
Why are you calling me after all these years, girl?
It's about my sister.
Lord rest her soul. You know not a day goes by that I don't miss Ava Neary.
Same here, Bernice.
She's the reason why I'm calling. There's a pause. I thought so. I saw you on the news back last summer.
You did?
For a split second when you first came on that screen, I would have sworn I was looking at Ava.
She was only 20 the last time you saw her, Bernice. I'm almost twice her age.
But you look exactly like her. It was like looking at a ghost. I thought about calling that hotline number they set up, you know? But then I lost my nerve.
Why were you going to call?
Trying to maintain her composure, Cam jerks open a kitchen drawer to look for a pad and pen.
Is there something I should know about my sister?
Maybe.
Cam bites her bottom lip to keep from asking why on earth Bernice hadn't called her. She doesn't want to scare her off now.
Back when it happened, and they said it was a suicide, I just figured that was the truth, Bernice tells her. It was hard to believe Ava would do that to herself, but a lot of things are hard to believe in this world. You hear what I'm saying?
Cam murmurs that she does.
Ava and I used to write letters when we were both away at school. That was what people did back then. None of this email, text, message, IM stuff like my grandbabies are doing. I remember your sister telling me in some of those letters not long before she died that she got herself involved in something she shouldn't have. At the time, I didn't think it was a big deal. But when I saw you on TV with those detectives saying she might have been murdered, well, I thought maybe I was wrong.
But you didn't tell me. Why not?
It's too late for admonishment. All Cam can do is listen and hope that she's on the verge of a breakthrough at last.
What was she involved in, Bernice? Drinking? Drugs?
No, nothing like that. It was a man.
You mean Ava had a boyfriend?
For a while, not a boy. A man, like I said. One of her professors.
Cam raises her eyebrows. None of the others who had known her sister in college had mentioned anything of the sort. But then, Bernice was like a sister to Ava. More like a sister, really, than Cam was, being so much younger. That would probably have changed as they grew older. They'd probably barely notice the age difference these days, if only Ava were still alive. If only.
What was this professor's name?
Lordy, hon, I don't even remember what I had for breakfast today.
So she was involved with him when she died?
I don't think so. I think she wrote me that it was over. Or maybe she just told me that. We used to speak on the phone once in a while, too. That was about as high-tech as things got back then.
She chuckles. Do you still have the letters, Bernice?
You know, I've been wondering about that. I never was one to throw stuff away. A pack rat, your sister called me. She always liked things nice and tidy, Ava.
She did? Really? My daughter's like that.
Oh, yes, Ava was Miss Perfect. Organized, neat as a pin.
Funny. That's something Cam never knew about her sister. Back then, she was too young to pay attention to that sort of thing. The unexpected new insight into her sister's personality makes her acutely aware of just what her family has lost, rather what was cruelly stolen from them.
Do you think you could look for the letters, Bernice?
I already did. I looked around the house a while back after I saw you on TV, but I couldn't find them. I suppose if I kept them, though, they wouldn't be here. I probably would have left them behind at my mother's house.
Do you think they're still there?